First of all, congratulations on the book, Walt. There are a lot of references in this book to Annapolis, to the Academy. What role did the Academy play in the lives of these four men?
Annapolis is really the common thread to all of these men. It's sort of interesting, Admiral Leahy, when he's a five-star fleet admiral at the end of his career, he's asked a question about, well, can you give us one example of an incident that really helped you in terms of defining your military career? And he pauses in answering this letter and says, no, I really can't. But then he goes on for four double-spaced typewritten pages and talks about nothing but Annapolis and what Annapolis meant in terms of his training, the camaraderie of the people he was associated with there. And each of these four men who became fleet admirals really have that common bond of Annapolis, their individual training, the men they went with, and it's with them throughout their entire careers.
It meant different things to each one of them, though, didn't it?
I think in some respects it did in terms of how they what they brought away from that. Leahy certainly brought away the battleship emphasis and everything. Nimitz, I think, really learned to be more of a team player. Halsey was very much involved with athletics at Annapolis and kind of a rough and tough brawler, if you will. And I think that was something that he carried through his career as well.
So after a short synopsis of Annapolis and what it means, you start this book, the meat of the book, on December 6, 1941. What was the state of the United States Navy that day, and where was each one of these four or five stars that you write about, Walt?
Well, the state of the U.S. Navy really had gone downhill after the First World War, but this is something that's sometimes not fully recognized, thanks in great measure to Franklin Roosevelt and to William D. Leahy, one of our four fleet admirals, who has been chief of naval operations. There's really, during the late 30s, and certainly by 1941, an increased buildup in Navy ships and the fact that Roosevelt recognizes that something is going to happen. Now, each of these four men are in different locations. Leahy has retired as Chief of Naval Operations, and he's actually ambassador to Vichy, France. And King is in the North Atlantic as commander of the North Atlantic, what at that point is just a really small fleet. And King sort of felt that he's going to be retired and out of action. But on December 6th, he's in the North Atlantic fighting this undeclared war with German U-boats. Nimitz is in Washington, D.C. as head of the Navy's Bureau of Navigation, essentially their Bureau of Personnel. And that's a fairly important job because he's had the files of all of these naval officers. He's made the assignments, deployments around the globe. And he really has a good idea of the men and their particular strengths and weaknesses that he's about to deploy all over the globe. Halsey, of course, is really on the front lines of all this because on December 6th, the day before Pearl Harbor, he's in command of the USS Enterprise aircraft carrier that has just delivered planes to Wake Island. And but for a little bit of delay, he actually would have been sailing into Pearl Harbor right at the time of the Japanese attack.
So as we are sitting here on December 6, 1941, and I read in your book, The Admirals, about where each of these men are, I take away a sense that no one really knows what is on the horizon. No one is really expecting that we'll be drawn full bore into this war some countries are already involved in, but we've seemed to have done well to stay out of up till that point. Is that a fair discernment on my part?
Well, I think I have a chapter that talks about at war in all but name, and I think that that's certainly true in terms of the North Atlantic, because King is very definitely fighting this undeclared war against German U-boats. There have been incidents of American ships coming under attack, incidents where American destroyers have attacked German U-boats in return. I think what it is fair to say in the Pacific is that while a number of folks, including Admiral Kimmel at Pearl Harbor, expect that there might be some Japanese attack in the Pacific. The more likely targets are thought to be either Singapore or the Philippines, and this idea of being so audacious as to make carrier strikes against Hawaii, not that many people really appreciate that. Now, interestingly enough, just as an aside, it's Admiral King a few years before, when he's been in command of American carriers in the Pacific as part of naval maneuvers, who actually stages a mock raid very similar to what the Japanese are going to do against Pearl Harbor. So there has been some warning, but again, this idea that Japan is going to move halfway across the Pacific with air power, many people just don't think that reach can be made.
I recall when 9/11 happened, a lot of commentators at that time referred to it as our generation's Pearl Harbor, our generation's Kennedy assassination. In your mind, having studied these men and studied these events, is that a fair comparison in your view?
I think that's an absolutely appropriate comparison. Everyone remembered where they were on December 7th, 1941, whether they heard it from a newsboy or whether they heard it coming out of the radio, sitting in their living rooms, or just shouts on the street, everyone remembered where they were. And I think that there, quite frankly, in the latter half of the 20th century, only two other events, exactly as you say, Kennedy's assassination and then, of course, 9/11.
So the war begins, and how does the life of each of these men change as the war commences and then progresses?
Things ramp up very quickly. King, from his post in the North Atlantic, is summoned to Washington almost immediately and given command of the U.S. fleet. Not just the Atlantic Fleet or the Pacific Fleet, but the entire fleet. And this is almost unprecedented in terms of Roosevelt saying to him, you know, we have somebody in King who may have ruffled some feathers from time to time, but we definitely need somebody now who is willing to knock a few heads together and get the ball rolling on being able to wage a two-ocean war. And Roosevelt and Secretary of the Navy Knox really have confidence in King in terms of his ability to do that. Nimitz is the same situation. Within a day of King being appointed commander-in-chief of the entire fleet, King, Knox, and Roosevelt decide that Nimitz is indeed the man to do things in the Pacific. And Roosevelt tells Nimitz, get out to Pearl Harbor and stay there until the war is over. And that's basically what happens. Nimitz goes to become commander-in-chief of the Pacific Fleet. Halsey, of course, continues with some carrier combat operations and commands in the Pacific. And Leahy, interestingly enough, as he's retired from Chief of Naval Operations in August of 1939, Roosevelt has said to him, Bill, you know, if we ever have a war, you're going to be right back here helping us win it. And, of course, during the period of early 1942, Roosevelt and the American leaders think that it's important to remain, keep relations with Vichy France and keep Leahy in position over there. But once it's clear that government is really just a puppet of Germany and Germany completes the invasion of France, takeover of France, then Leahy is recalled to Washington, D.C. in July of 1942 to become essentially Roosevelt's chief of staff, his chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and really his national security advisor. All of those positions that weren't officially known by those names at that point, Leahy steps into that role.
At that time, as you mentioned, some of the roles that we think of automatically now didn't exist. What's the significance of the choices, in particular of Leahy, for that chief of staff and de facto chairman of the Joint Chiefs selection?
Leahy is definitely the overlooked member of the foursome of the fleet admirals. And I think that Roosevelt, with the encouragement of Army Chief of Staff Marshall and certainly the concurrence of King, who's commander-in-chief of the U.S. fleet, and then becomes Chief of Naval Operations as well, sort of a combined appointment. Both of those men recognized that Roosevelt needs somebody to sort of run interference, if you will, between the White House and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So what's happening is that Roosevelt turns to somebody that he really has confidence in because he's known Leahy since before the First World War. He's worked with him as Chief of Naval Operations, and he turns to Leahy and says, I really want you to manage the armed forces and the Joint Chiefs of Staff and report to me on a daily, sometimes almost an hourly basis. And I think the example, it's a small example, but I think it's really important about how close Leahy becomes to Roosevelt. Whenever Roosevelt is traveling on his private rail car, the Ferdinand Magellan, the president is in the presidential quarters, but the compartment immediately next door is always occupied by Leahy. And except for one time when Leahy's sick, Leahy is at Roosevelt's side in all of the World War II conferences.
Now, given his background, it's not surprising to me that President Roosevelt had a soft spot in his heart for the wisdom and leadership of a Navy man.
Well, he did, but I think the record really shows that he was pretty balanced in that. I think he felt more comfortable, perhaps, dealing with the Navy. And one of the reasons I point out in the book that I think he felt more comfortable with Leahy during this period of time than maybe the Army is that Leahy really is a team player, the ultimate aide who is responsible for implementing the president's policies. And there was never any question of Leahy's agenda. Leahy always sought to serve Franklin Roosevelt. By contrast, during the 30s before the war, who's the Army Chief of Staff? Well, the Army Chief of Staff is Douglas MacArthur, and there's a whole different persona there and certainly a whole different relationship. You know, Franklin Roosevelt famously said that, along with Huey Long, that Douglas MacArthur was the most dangerous man in the country during the 1930s. So, I mean, that's part of the reason, I think, that Roosevelt was more comfortable dealing with Leahy.
One of the blurbs on your book is from a colleague, fellow author, Thomas Fleming. He writes, "The portrait of the forgotten Admiral Leahy is worth the whole book." Why is Leahy forgotten? Was there a sense at that time that because he was retired and now on to his ambassadorship that maybe his time as a Navy leader had passed?
No, I think it's actually maybe just the reverse of that. It's this quality that Leahy has to do FDR's bidding and not to seek publicity. Now, King and Nimitz get much more publicity, and so does Halsey, because they sort of come to personify the American naval effort. It's interesting to look at Time magazine and life during this period of time and remember that during the Second World War, these magazines are really the way that a number, vast majority of Americans get their news of what's going on. And Nimitz and King, and particularly Halsey, have their photos on the cover of these magazines, have articles about them, quotes about them, and Leahy almost never, I think it's only three or four times that his name even appears in these magazines during a period of time in 1943 and 1944. So Leahy is not out in front, either giving interviews or, you know, pushing his own personal agenda, but he's simply working for Franklin Roosevelt and making sure that Roosevelt's policies are put into place. So he's the ultimate team player and the ultimate person who is behind the scenes and yet very, very important. Somebody that Roosevelt leaned on to the same extent that Roosevelt leaned on Harry Hopkins earlier in the war. And the reason that he comes to lean on Leahy even more as time goes by is Hopkins himself becomes very ill and is not himself, particularly in 44 and 45. When I write in the book about Leahy maybe not being acting president, but certainly being a very, very important and hands-on chief of staff and being the one who keeps the mechanisms of the White House running.
You mentioned the promotion and how people became aware of these men. You have a fantastic graphic in this book. The photo section is terrific. But in particular, there's one from the Naval History and Heritage Command. It's captioned at the bottom, "Victory Begins at Home." It's a picture of Halsey, and he's the Marlboro Man. He is the tough guy that you are happy he is leading this effort in the United States. And some words around it, like hit hard, hit fast, hit often, produce for your Navy. This is the kind of thing that I'm trying to imagine someone producing, the government producing and putting out today, and people laughing at it. But this was really what kept people on the home front engaged in what was going on, wasn't it? Understanding that people like Halsey and these other men were at the front of this effort.
This was big stuff, and Halsey definitely personifies the American effort in the Pacific during the Second World War. In 1942, January and February, when things are still very, very tenuous, Halsey leads a couple of carrier raids in the Marshall and Gilbert Islands. And, of course, later he becomes the task force commander for the Doolittle raid, taking Enterprise and Hornet close to Japan. And based on those early experiences and the interviews he gives, he really becomes the face of the naval effort in the Pacific. You know, it's kind of interesting. I researched this Bull Halsey. Everybody talks about Halsey with that nickname. Well, even Halsey himself didn't know where that came from, and it's not in play in 1942. It just really begins at the end of 42 and into 43, but then that's the way he's known. And it's, it sort of goes back to that brawler image at Annapolis, that he's a fighter. He's tough as nails, and he's got that kind of spirit and that kind of charisma that makes men follow him. And whether you're commanding a ship in his task force or the lowest seaman, you really want to go through and do all you can to win the war.
The description of the rest of the war and the course that these men take throughout it is fascinating, and I'll leave that to someone who wants to get this book, The Admirals Nimitz, Halsey, Leahy, and King, the five-star admirals who won the war at sea. I want to ask you about the interpersonal workings of the relationships these four men. They had Annapolis in common, as we talked about. They had long distinguished Navy careers in common, as is obvious from their service. What were their interpersonal relationships like? What did they have in common, and how were they different?
One of the more interesting relationships, I think, is between King and Nimitz. Two more different people you couldn't imagine. King was very much a hard to the line, strict disciplinarian, somebody who rankled the feathers of both his superiors and his subordinates. Quite frankly, he was an SOB and seemingly proud of it, and he had that reputation throughout the Navy. Now, Nimitz, on the other side, was the kind of leader who would sort of put his hand on your shoulder and say, you know, let's get this thing done. We're all in this together, and whether he was giving orders or whether he was giving instruction by way of teaching, he was somebody who really did it in a calm, measured way. So they really come at leadership from two different 180-degree polar opposites. But they came to work together very well when, in the spring of 1942, they make their first meeting together. Nimitz is in the Pacific, is commander-in-chief in the Pacific. King's the commander of the entire U.S. fleet, and they really work out a good mutual situation where King gives Nimitz and trusts Nimitz, gives him plenty of room to make the decisions within King's overall overarching strategy of what needs to be done in the Pacific. King finally, throughout his career, he's never really been able to delegate. He's never really been able to leave his hands off the most minute of matters. But finally, in his relationship with Nimitz, I think, during the war, King's able to do that and trust Nimitz to get the job done in the Pacific. You know, Nimitz and King both have known Halsey for years, and I think that particularly after the Battle of Leyte Gulf and Halsey gets into some situations with a couple of typhoons in the Pacific, that other people might well have perhaps asked for his head, Halsey's head, but King and Nimitz, I think, realized that Halsey has become so important in the American public's mind in terms of what's going on that they really can't bring down a hero of his reputation. So they treat Halsey a little bit with kid gloves, if you will, toward the end of the war.
That attitude that Nimitz held throughout his career stems from a story that you tell toward the beginning of the book about an experience that Nimitz himself had on the Decatur. What's that story, and what do you think it? How do you think it impacted Nimitz's approach to leadership and command throughout his career?
Well, Nimitz was a very young ensign at this point in the command of an old destroyer called the Decatur that actually he ran aground in the Philippines coming into a harbor. And whether it was exactly his fault or whether there were some title charts that were misplaced, who knows for sure, but the point of the story would be that Nimitz himself, even though he got the ship, and of course running aground in the Navy is about the worst possible thing that you can do in terms of captain of a vessel, but a passing steamer pulled the Decatur off this sandbar, and Nimitz could have gone ahead and said nothing, but following regulations, he went ahead and reported it. And the end of the story really is that his superiors at the time looked at his record, looked at his forthrightness in terms of reporting it and what he had done, and gave him a reprimand, but did not give him the court-martial that might have really sunk his entire naval career. So I think the lesson that Nimitz took away from that is that you give people a little bit of slack and encourage them to both learn by experience and come away from an experience determined to do better next time. And that's really the leadership example and approach that Nimitz brought to his entire career when the tables were turned and he was a leader of men.
How did that match the leadership approaches of the other four men that you study in this book?
Well, again, King's approach was very, very strict. And he's someone who would simply berate. I tell a story in the book of he's on an aircraft carrier and he's berating people for not being able to park planes correctly so that they have enough space. Well, he marches down to the deck and is giving orders and chewing people out right and left and determines to move the planes about himself. And, of course, when he's done, he's ended up not gaining feet. He's ended up losing 10 feet of space. But still, of course, he's not one to admit that. Nimitz probably would have taken an entirely different approach, but he also would have admitted that he was wrong. King certainly was never one to admit he was wrong, and it was always someone else's fault, which is why I think it's kind of interesting that at the end of the day, faced with managing this two-ocean war, that he's able to finally delegate and give some hands-off room to Nimitz in order to implement things. One point about King that's interesting, I think that if Leahy is overlooked as far as the man in the White House and the man at FDR's side, then King is really overlooked, I think, as someone who is a global strategist in terms of being able to balance a two-ocean war. Resources are very, very limited. There's really the Navy is spread thin all over the world, and somehow, in addition to supporting Great Britain and making efforts across the North Atlantic, King is not only able to hold the line in the Pacific, but he definitely is the one who comes up with the plan as early as March of 1942 that says we've got to hold some key points, but we also have to begin to strike back. And, of course, that striking back eventually leads to the actions around Guadalcanal and the Solomons.
The way you describe that in the book is fantastic. I want to ask you in the time that we have left some things about this story from your perspective. You have written perhaps the seminal book on the French and Indian War, on the presidency of James K. Polk. Your other work primarily focuses around the 18th and 19th centuries. What drew you into the 20th century and to this story in particular?
Well, interestingly enough, I think that my work has probably been about westward expansion and the growth of the United States, and certainly the French and Indian War, 1812, and I've written a book on transcontinental railroads in the Southwest. It's all this movement sort of westward, and America going from simply something along the east coast of the United States to a world power. And to that point, I think 1898 and the Spanish-American War is sort of the beginning of America stepping onto the world stage. And when I became ready to ponder that a little bit, I started to think about the men who were involved with it. And these four men are all at Annapolis at that particular point. But by the time they come of age with the Spanish-American War and then get involved with the Navy and go through the major changes, particularly in terms of submarines, aircraft carriers, and naval aviation, that takes place in their 40-odd year career, by the time they're done at September 2nd, 1945, at the end of the Second World War, America really has gone from a continental power to the undisputed global power. So I think it kind of fits in with some of my themes, but certainly these four men are fascinating to watch individually and certainly fascinating to watch in terms of the growth and development of the American Navy.
So when you started on this book, I imagine that you had a conception of what it might look like or how it might shape up as you went through the project. As you did so, what surprised you? What did you learn that you weren't expecting, or what did you come across that you weren't expecting?
I think the thing that surprised me the most, and perhaps it's because I knew the least about him, as so many people do, was the role of William D. Leahy. And I think that Leahy is important not only to Franklin Roosevelt, but the amazing thing, which I really didn't understand or know in the beginning, is how Leahy then transitions in 1945 from that kind of close advisor to Roosevelt and does the same thing for Harry Truman. I write in the book that I think that it's really Leahy, through his memos and through his counsel, who fills Truman in with so much of what the Roosevelt policies were, including things like the atomic bomb, and really educates Harry Truman to the presidency. And Leahy serves as Truman's advisor, much as he's done with Roosevelt, for that entire remainder of the term until 1949 that Truman is serving the completion of Roosevelt's fourth term. And I think, just again, a little anecdotal story, what really emphasizes that is that when Truman finally retires in 1953, that the man that he chooses to sit at his right hand as they have sort of the final little dinner there at the White House with Truman's cronies is Admiral Leahy. And I think Truman really appreciated that role.
When someone goes and buys this book or has it shipped to the house and they sit and read it, by the way, it's a terrific read for sitting next to a body of water and looking out over the water and imagining these men doing what they do on the water. When someone completes it, what do you want them to take away from this book, Walt?
Well, I'd like them to take away an appreciation of these four men, different though they were. But I think I'd also like them to take away two other things. One, certainly at the macro level, is the idea that the American Navy changed so much during their careers. It changed from a line of battleships to where today we're talking about submarines and nuclear aircraft carriers and really being able to project American naval power around the globe. You know, sometimes that's for military purposes, but frequently it's for humanitarian purposes as well. And the other thing that I'd like them to take away from it, and I've tried to put little stories throughout the book that talk about the relationships of these men with the rank and file of the sailors and what they were able to instill them to accomplish because of their leadership. And whether you're a lowly seaman or a fleet admiral, it really was, as Halsey's poster that you alluded to before would say, a team effort to get the job done and bring victory in the Second World War.
Authors have told me before that their books are like children, so you'll never completely get away from the admirals, but I imagine you have something on your radar screen to go to next.
Well, that's an interesting thing. You always have something that you're working on. It seems you're out promoting one book and talking about it, but you can't rest. And I am working on some research that will take me actually to fill in one of the holes between my earlier books. And I'm working on something on the American Revolution.